Human fear is a powerful force. We have all heard of those incredible feats of strength and speed that have been fueled by adrenaline. And we now know that there's an additional response besides fight and flight, that there's a freeze response that can happen when the body just shuts down in a form of almost like paralysis in the face of really traumatic pain. So when I say in the sermon title that fear contracts, I trust that we all have some body memory of muscles tightening, of our breath growing shallow, of our vision getting smaller, our focus singular as we perceive a threat coming our way and feel the panic that rises to get rid of it. There are, of course, a myriad of ways in which these responses are helpful. They keep us safe and alive. The human race wouldn't be here without them. But it can also make us vulnerable. Vulnerable to manipulation. Advertisers and politicians have long learned how to leverage this fear response to turn us into willing consumers or to influence our vote. Those who can induce fear in us hold tremendous power over us. But I learned recently about one more dimension, one more aspect of how it is that our vision gets so narrow when we are in a fear response. Now, it was something that came out in a study 5 years ago, actually, this week, in the journal Science, but this is not my field. I had not read it and heard about it until just a week or two ago. But it was a really fascinating study on the impact of poverty on what they were calling their people's cognitive load, which refers to our capacity for mental energy. And so the way they conducted the study is they took some shoppers in New Jersey and some sugarcane farmers in India. And what they did is test their ability to make decisions. And for the farmers, they did this right before the harvest when they were particularly low on cash reserve, and then retested just after the harvest when they were financially flush. And they did the same thing in a different way with these New Jersey shoppers, and they found exactly the same thing, which is that when people are fearful about not having enough, it is the equivalent of losing 13 IQ points. Same people, before and after the harvest. Fascinating. If you look at this whole picture about how fear operates, it's very clear that any perception of threat drives so much of the tribalism that fuels division and violence in our world. The moment you perceive threat and you define someone or something as the enemy, fear kicks in and all of the contraction that goes along with it. Which is why I've always felt the whole language of spiritual warfare is fairly unhelpful. Puts us in that space where we feel all the contraction of fear. Now, I know the last time I preached this text, which was about 9 years ago, I told you about the church that I served during college. It was a really big church, and it was in that time when that novel series, that book series, This Present Darkness, was becoming popular. And that language of spiritual warfare, which was all throughout these novels, was also all over that church that I was serving. And I have to tell you, that congregation loved this passage and others like it from Ephesians that draw on military images, the armor of God battling with the devil. And I'm aware that my aversion to passages like this can be traced back to that time. But I was thinking a little more generously about it this last week. And when you feel yourself under threat, which the church was experiencing at the time Ephesians was circulating, it makes sense that you would pull on those images that the world has taught you to trust when you are feeling fearful, images of enemy and weaponry. Well, Walter Wink was one of the people along the way that helped me to reclaim some of this imagery, and I just put together in my brain this week that he did his work on the powers and principalities at exactly the same time this series was really popular. I don't actually think they influenced each other, but it's kind of fascinating to see late 80s, early 90s, people in lots of places were thinking about these things. And I just told you how old I am. What Walter Wink does is re-envision this imagery that we have from the scriptures about the powers and principalities. Not seeing them as supernatural forces of evil, kind of behind all things, which is what was happening in that novel, but looking instead at the cumulative force, the ethos, and the spirituality that animates the power structures that govern this world. That's how he defined the powers and principalities. Because there's no question that evil exists in the world, right? That harm and destruction can invade any and all spheres of life. And what Walter Wink was trying to capture is the way in which it can take on a life of its own, can begin to seep into the air that we breathe. And sadly, we've seen that invasion into the church. It's been writ large in the news of late. And it's inevitable that when you feel yourself under attack, that you look for some tools to fight or flee or hide. And as I said, the church at the time Ephesians was circulating was feeling itself threatened. It was fragmenting and pulling apart. So drawing on these images that we know from the contracted places of fear makes sense. Perception of threat, defining an enemy, the weaponry of armor. But what's really interesting to me as I look at this passage from Ephesians is that the vision is expansive. It's about standing firm. And while the images do draw from weaponry, the actual tools in this so-called armor of God are given to help us not to fight or flee or freeze, but to face what it is that scares us. And the tools are things like truth and righteousness. We are invited to find whatever it takes to proclaim the gospel of peace. We are to draw upon our faith, which is another way of talking about our trust in God, and to let salvation guide us. And what we mean by salvation is that holistic vision of shalom that shows us how to live in relationship with each other and with God and in the world. To take this vision of life that we learn from God's word and to let these things help us when we feel the world closing in and our bodies shutting down. Which, of course, is why we need to do this life of faith together, so that when one of us is feeling fear and it's all closing in and we're getting ready to fight, and someone else, hopefully, the Spirit's moving, can help us see something a little differently, open something up that we hadn't considered before. In this passage from 1 Kings today, as Solomon is dedicating the temple, he recognizes that it is the nature of God to be expansive, to go beyond any limits that we might try to place on the divine. He establishes the temple as a place of God's name, a place that will be a sign and a symbol of God's presence, which I think churches to this day, places of worship all over the world do. But Walter Brueggemann reminds us in his commentary on this text that the whole enterprise of building the temple is a bit of a mixed bag. Because, of course, there is the aspiration I've just named, which is beautiful. But the temple also serves to bolster Solomon's political power. It's built with questionable integrity. Seems he used some forced labor to bring this grand vision to fruition. And then there's the affluence. Beauty, in some ways, is a wonderful way to give honor to God. We are in a beautiful space. But the mention of the cedar, which he acquires through trade agreements, will be fodder for some prophetic fire a little later on. Read Jeremiah 22. And churches, from the beginning, have also been a mixed bag. right? We are, of course, a place that aspires to bring people to the honor and love of God, a place where we want to grow into our very best selves. But it's also a place where we inevitably act out of our sinfulness and our fallenness. But somehow in the midst of this temple dedication that lifts up the best of our affirmations and reveals some of the worst of human impulses, there is this profound truth that Solomon speaks that I read to the children today. Even the heavens, the highest heavens, cannot contain you, he writes, much less this house that I have built. Friends, this is good news, that God cannot be contained, that God is free and expansive, that God is alive and at work in every part of creation and beyond. And even as people of faith are prone to do, Israel does, which is to take their special nature as the people of God and at times view it in very narrow and exclusive terms. We've got all kinds of strands that teach people to be suspicious of foreigners. But here in this temple dedication, Solomon is able to say that even the foreigners will worship God in truth. And this passage reminded me of one of our confessions. We pull it out a couple of times a year in our life of worship. It's called Our Song of Hope. It's written in 1978. And it invites us to profess these lines. God has not been left without a witness. The word has entered where we have failed to go. A little further on, it says, Christ's hand reaches out beyond those who say, Lord, to the infants who live in the atmosphere of faith, even to the farthest stars and planets, all creation. The boundaries of God's love are not known. The Spirit works at the ends of the earth before the church has there spoken a word. It's a pretty bold confession. And it invites us to enter into the world with a really different attitude than the contraction of fear with which we began. Now, I know it's just the kids who are heading back to school and the educators among us, but we're on the edge of a new program year in the life of this church, and you can kind of feel the change of season in the air. But even if there's nothing in your day-to-day life that is going to change, let's just take the opportunity that every morning provides us to turn the page and do that together today. And so I invite us to just take a deep breath right now and take in this truth about the expansive and free nature of God's Spirit. Believe me, I pray that you encounter God when you come into this time and this space. But as you go, I fully trust you will encounter God there. And so let us go out into this place with a posture of expectation. Because the promise is that wherever we go, God's Spirit goes with us and, in fact, before us. And God promises to hear our prayer, to heed our deepest needs, to forgive us when we falter and fall, and then to help us to stand firm and face whatever comes. So with that in mind, let us offer our thanks to God. Amen.